Sorry.
I will repeat. So, yes. So our next session is about discussing altered states of consciousness of varying degrees and styles and comparing them as far as we can with autogenic training. So we've all prepared something. How would you like to start? I think I'm going to put myself last because I'm sharing something with Luta. So I will go last. Who would like to
I think
start?
I'm
Well,
the only student.
you sent out my notes that I did to the AGM,
Yes,
which
the
cover
relax.
actually cover transcendental meditation, biofeedback, and the relaxation response. So it gives the history of that. And have you read it, Bevan and Pia? Yeah. So that's there, and then biofeedback. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I've read them, even though I was allocated transcendental meditation. So I think that one slipped through my net. Maybe I should have just taken yours. I've missed a trick there, haven't I, ladies?
Well, funnily enough, as I was reading them, I was thinking, yeah, they could pinch this very easily. Yes, anyway, okay. Well, Anne, what about if you start with the biofeedback, yeah, with that sort of historical background on relaxation? It was
Well,
absolutely brilliant.
the historical background is worth just spending a moment on because it actually leads you up to biofeedback, which
Right.
is a development from
Yeah,
that.
yeah.
So, if we look at the history of the relaxation response and the understanding of that goes right back to the end of the 19th century. So we have people like Claude Bernard and Walter Cannon. I think you should know that the development of the understanding of physiological parameters and the way that the physiology was regulated from within, and where the word homeostasis comes from, which is the staying, the organ stability, the staying power of the body. And disease and pathology could therefore be seen as a breakdown in this stability, either of specific organs or more generalized. So homeostasis, which is where all the systems actually keep themselves within a certain limits, like the body temperature, like the oxygen saturation, all of those physiological parameters are kept with very carefully within certain range, otherwise we're in trouble. And so from that, we developed the understanding of the stress response or the fight or flight. And then Walter Cannon actually went on to describe the research in psychosomatic medicine, the wisdom of the body. And interestingly enough, he was a physiologist who actually specialized in the physiology of swallowing and the physiology of the digestive organs. And this is very pertinent to my solar plexus is warm. He became interested in the physiological effects of emotions on digestive function and found that when animals were stressed, peristalsis, the muscular activity of the gut, ceased abruptly. And I am a living example of that. Because if I have stress, I don't poo, full stop. It stops. So we all have a system where stress goes to mostly, and biofeedback brings that there. So the relaxation response was actually developed and quantified by, first of all, observing yogis who could slow their heart rate and breathing while meditating, and then a cardiologist also investigated this, but at this time was using ECG and EEG recordings. So here we get to the equipment of examining the meditative practice, the ones that yogis have been using. And they found that alpha activity is recorded when the individual ceases to pay attention or respond to any stimulus which would normally block this particular brainwave pattern. And the stimulus can be cognitive, that's thinking, somatic, the body or emotional. And alpha waves have the quality of synchronicity, producing a state of serenity, happiness, and even bliss. Now, we know that with all the meditative practices, and we know that AT, we have the alpha theta wavelengths. So we got, I'll just read this bit out. Taken from the ancient text of Veda is the science, knowledge, and truth required for a perfect life. The Maharishi Mani Yoga, a Vedic scholar and scientist of consciousness, when his teacher had died, he decided to embark on the year of global awakening, and his intention was to bring transcendental meditation to thousands. On his way, he was an ambassador for world peace, which he hoped the enlightened effects of TM would bring. So their TM was taken around the world. And in the US, TM arrived in about 1959, and it became widely practiced. And TM was part of the spiritual regeneration program. And this is very interesting. In 1950s and 60s in particular, were the decades of heart attacks and sudden death. And an American cardiologist discovered that in actual fact, one of the risk factors for cardiovascular disease was type A behavior. I mean, you've all heard of type A behavior. And so type A was strongly associated with a risk of heart disease, and was described as a driven individual, oppressed by time, competitive and hostile. So that was understood. And then the next thing was that Herbert Benson, cardiologist and physiologist, actually took notes of this, and he actually changed the name of TM to the relaxation response. So you can see how all these are interconnected. And he used this in preference to make it more acceptable to the scientific and medical world. And he is the person who wrote the relaxation response. So he set up the Mind Body Institute and was a founder member of the American Stress Institute. And then we have Hans Seeley, known as Dr. Stress, who was the mate, who coined the symptoms in being the syndrome, stress being the syndrome of changes occurring as a response to a stressor, and his description of the general adaptation syndrome, which we looked at in the physiology and biochemistry of SIP, showing the stages of alarm, resistance, and recovery is a physical, and emotional blueprint of how our lives are led. So so that's the background to ancient meditative practice, to transcendental meditation coming to the West, becoming the relaxation response. And all the time underlying this is the understanding of the physiological changes that occur with the different states of arousal and mental and physical activity. So to get on now to biofeedback. So biofeedback became a discrete practice in the 1960s and was widely used in clinical practice. And it's based on three simple principles. The first one is that neurophysiological functions, which can be monitored and measured, can be fed back to the individual for them to understand the experience of that in relation to their health or symptoms. So you're actually having the measurements going on and you are experiencing yourself, but the instruments are showing you whether they're extra active or not active. So you actually begin to understand how you feel when there are certain of these functions going on. And the thing is that every change in the physiological state is accompanied by a change in the mental and emotional state. And every change in the emotional and mental state is accompanied by a change in the physiological state. Now, that is the basis of the work that we do. That is the basis of the work that we do. I mean, me speaking to you now sort of highly focused, and that there will be all sorts of physiological changes going on in me. And a meditative state allows the individual to become aware of subliminal imagery and sensations. And it's this awareness that allows for the development of voluntary control of the autonomic systems. Of course, that is something that is a contradiction in terms. Autonomic is actually automatic and can't be altered by sub-image sensations. But in biofeedback, this is what you're learning to do. So the most obvious and available measurement is the pulse rate. Electrocardiograph, the ECG, electrocardiograph traces will give a more detailed information about the heart function. So we're familiar with the ECG. It gives the heart rate, and it gives actually the quality of the heartbeat. We've got the respiratory rate and oxygen saturation, so they can be measured. We've got oximeters that you put on people's fingers now, and you can count the breath, and you can watch the respiration. The electromyograph gives information of voluntary muscles, activity, and tension, and the electroencephalogram records brainwave activity, and the galvanic skin resistance records the moisture of the skin, which is reduced by setting with stress. So we've got ECG, respiratory rate, electromyograph, we've got five things that we can measure with equipment. Okay. So these health measures are always changing at time. And watching the monitor, the person begins to realize that very minor changes, this is important, very minor changes in posture or changing the breath, even flexing a finger, can have a marked effect on the heart rate. Exploring more subtle effects on the heart rate by thinking about something pleasurable or being faced with a difficult task, the immediacy of biofeedback can give instant information about how the various systems are reacting. So one way of using biofeedback in practice was to use it to produce a neurophysiological stress profile. So you sort of have a baseline, and you have all those five instruments that give you measurements at baseline. And one thing that you can do with that is to use to produce. We know that the damage from excessive stress will manifest itself in a specific organ or function. We've all got an organ or a function that responds to stress more quickly and more markedly than others. And a neurophysiological profile is intended to detect which system is showing signs of damage or dysfunction first before more symptoms or gross pathology is manifested. So that's really quite clear. So when the person is alert and engaged in a complex task, maybe it's got a mathematical problem, the neurophysiological profile, which you have made, will show a moderate stress response over all the parameters. After relaxation is induced, the indices are recorded again and compared with the first readings. By doing this, it's possible to identify systems which do not show flexibility or ability to change. It may be that the EEG, the electrocardiogram, and the record both go up during stress, but with relaxation, perhaps or only the EMG returns to normal, and the EEG recording remains high, indicating that the person, though physically relaxed, remains in a state of hyperarousal or anxiety. With this information, the patient can learn to regulate this dysfunction by using relaxation techniques, and with biofeedback, watching the changes which occur, developing a confidence and trust in their bodily functions. So this feedback practice was particularly used for conditions such as hypertension, migraine, digestive disease, IBS, fibromyalgia and pain syndromes, tension headaches, and of course, anxiety, which accompanies all these chronic conditions. So I finished off this thing. So having followed the trail to relaxation and biofeedback, I think it's clear that there are elements common to all the mind-body practices, whichever technique is being used. So we've got, firstly, adopting a comfortable position or posture, being still with eyes closed, making mental contact with various parts of the body, paying attention, detached observation, allowing for thoughts and feelings, but not responding or reacting to them, noticing, allowing, and letting go, allowing to happen that which needs to happen, the wisdom of the body, lots of practice. And I finished off by saying, of course, that pretty well describes our autogenic method. So there we have, and there's such a lot of crossover of these different discrete practices, but they have these common elements. One of the things about biofeedback, although I've never witnessed anybody, it must have been very unsettling to have all that equipment stuck on you. So I don't know. It reminds me of, you know, people who go to sleep clinics, and they go to sleep clinics and they have all this stuff stuck on them. I couldn't sleep if they had all that stuff stuck on them. So I think equipment must have its inherently has have its own problems. So that was just a sort of brief overview of the history of the relaxation response, transcendental meditation, and then starting to relaxation response and then biofeedback. Amen.
Thank you so much. What a brilliant summing up. We said 5 minutes, but you've given us so much in that, in an enormous overview in a very succinct fashion. Any comments, questions? I think what you last said, Anne, sums it up so beautifully. There are so many overlaps. You can't really pin them all down. Autogenics seems to do everything except
that. I say that, you know, a lot of things overlap, but the autogenic practice is a discrete therapy. And I think discrete is a very useful word because it separates it from others, as hypnosis is a discrete practice. TM, you know, they're all discrete. They have common elements, but they have their own particular discrete methods.
And this is what they use in NASA, isn't it? The biofeedback with autogenics still to this day. So for NASA, the astronauts, I understand that they, still to this day, they use biofeedback and autogenics together.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Okay.
I wonder, this is tongue-in-cheek, how often astronauts do offloading exercises. I think that's the end of that question. We'll shut it down again. I shouldn't think they are taught, actually. I think that what was happening in NASA is so many years ago, it's probably not our autogenics.
Apparently, they still use it.
Oh, yes, autogenics, yes. But I'm talking about the offloading. Which really is...
Oh, that I don't know.
Yeah. No, we don't know. That's why I just raised it as an amusing question. It's all right. We can let it go.
Well, they wouldn't unless they were taught by BAS, would they?
Absolutely. No, I think that's right. I think that's right.
Yeah.
So, yes, I haven't been to NASA, so, hey, end of story.
Can I ask on that note then? So in terms of, like, the branches of autogenic training, Is it only in the UK that the training is provided with the six standard exercises following kind of Luther's branch with the offloading exercise?
No, Schultz's original autogenic training contained the six standard exercises.
Yeah,
that is a given, and that has never been altered.
Yeah, I'm aware of that.
So Luther developed the offloading exercises, and he happened to arrive in the UK just as he was sort of getting them better known, and the little bits of research he'd managed to do were beginning to come out. And that was in the late 70s. And that was when he was developing it. It was in the early 80s that he came over and gave them to us. And we took it up just from his afternoon lectures, one each, on the crying, the anxiety, and the anger exercises.
And there was the dying and the vomiting.
We don't use the dying.
No,
one.
I know, but I was taught those when I went to Malcolm Carruthers.
When you went, right?
So
they were there.
The dying.
But they were there. That's absolutely
dying
right.
Exercise I remember very well, and the vomiting exercise.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And we can teach you those. That's all right, you two. We will do that with the discretion that they demand. We will talk about them. That's the point. So
wanted to clarify my question. So what I was curious about was whether or not in other countries, what their approach is to training autogenics. Are they doing kind of the six standard exercises and that's it?
Oh yes.
It emerged into something completely different. Where is it being taught as we are learning it, if at all? I guess I was just curious.
I am not aware that it is anywhere but the UK what we do.
Okay.
Having said that, I was invited to Germany actually not too long ago to introduce the Germans of all people to the offloading exercises.
Really?
Which they were very intrigued by. I don't know if they used them. I have no idea if they took it up. And I know that Luther was working in Japan. So it could be that they do them in Japan, but we don't really know. And that's as far as I know. And whether the sixth standard has morphed into anything else, I think the principle is always the sixth standard, but you do find some funny old things on the internet, with some of it, but an awful lot of direction in it, and people have lost touch. If anything, they might be doing the same stuff, but with a different style, not always about trusting the natural processes, that there is a sort of, let's do the breathing exercise so that we can get to this result. It's all got tinged with result focus, the strange stuff that I read sometimes.
If you look at sometimes the practices, the wording has changed.
Yeah.
And the way that it's actually spoken internally has changed. I can't remember which book it was, 80. And it's subtle differences in the wording and the number of times you say something and so on. And things like, and I'm very peaceful and calm and things like, So it's we have a very structured standard thing and we stick by it.
Yeah.
Full stop.
Absolutely.
And that you learn it like that and then develop your own style, but you retain the actual standard formula and mostly the wording and the way it's presented.
And thank you, Anne, you're so right, because it's just very concise what we do as well.
Yes,
and
yes,
it sums
yes.
it up beautifully. It's yes. less is more, actually.
Yeah.
And there are some books. There's one book where one exercise session was about 3 pages long and somebody had to learn it off by heart. And then they're putting, I am, as you say, Anne, very peaceful and calm in between each of the other standard exercises.
Yeah,
it got
yeah,
ridiculous,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
absolutely
yeah,
ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
So what we have, I think, is a gold standard. I'm always impressed by the structure of our course. It's absolutely brilliant. It is superb.
So it makes me think one of the ways that I use it is if 80 is a simple, structured meditative practice,
yeah,
enabling a gear change, a change in physical, mental, and emotional value. And I think it's that simplicity and the structure that enables people to actually take it on board quite quickly and get a result quite quickly before the next bit and it moves out. So a simple structure. Yeah.
Right. We should move on, I think. Thank you so much. That's a wonderful starting point, actually. It's a real overview of this sort of interlinking with a lot of things. Who's going next? Oh, Donna, you're down for two.
I know.
Oh.
Shall I go next? Because I'm sorry.
I was going to say, if you want me to follow on with my bit about TM, if that fits in logically here, I'm happy to. Or if it fits in better after yours, Donna.
No, you go for it, because I'm going to bring the side right down after that.
Yeah, okay, let me get my notes up. Where are we? Okay, so it was really interesting and to hear you talk about the history, because I didn't approach it from that way. I kind of looked at kind of what it is and how it might be different to autogenic training, although I'm quoting what I've found online because I've never practiced transcendental meditation myself. So it's a specific technique of meditation that was introduced in the mid-20th century by a yogi of the name Maharishi Mahesh. It's a form of silent mantra meditation, which involves the repetition of a specific sound or mantra to facilitate a state of deep relaxation and mental clarity. So there's a little bit of similarity there in that in autogenic training, we are silently repeating the autogenic formula. How it differs is that a mantra is usually one word. It's a private word that's given in a mantra giving ceremony. So even though it's not religious, or they're very keen to say that it isn't religious in its practices, there is at that point, you know, a picture of the guru in there, and it does have religious origins in that it comes from the Hindu practice of meditation. That doesn't mean to say that people of all walks and faiths in life can't practice it and find it beneficial. Where also there are similarities is that you learn transcendental meditation by a teacher, a trained teacher, but you can learn it perhaps more quickly than you can learn autogenic training, because I think you can learn it in about a week. And you practice it for 15 to 20 minutes twice a day. So there's a slight difference there in that we encourage people in autogenic training to do three practices, and those are shorter, of up to maybe 10 minutes. And with transcendental meditation, the practitioner is encouraged to sit comfortably with the eyes closed. So it's a seated position that they're using. Whereas with autogenic training, we have the three postures initially that are trained, although we do say that once you've learned it, you can then practice it really anywhere in your daily life when there's a need or an opportunity to do so. One of the things they say is that in repeating the mantra, it's to be repeated effortlessly and naturally without any deliberate concentration or control. So that reminded me of the thing that's quite key in what we're learning about autogenic training is passive awareness and passive concentration. And your notes again talked about that and the noticing and the allowing and the letting go. And the goal of TM, as it's referred to, is to transcend or go beyond the surface level thinking and experience a state of pure awareness or transcendental consciousness. It's described as a state of deep inner calm, mental clarity, and restful alertness. So in a way, I guess there's, you know, some similarities in that it's an altered state of consciousness. I don't know how the state of autogenic altered state of consciousness is different or similar to transcendental consciousness. I'd need to go and practice those and make my own conclusions, like we probably all would. I wonder what putting, what was that one called? Is it an E? The one that measures the brain waves. What was that?
Electroencephalogram.
That's it. Yeah, I wonder, you know, practicing it, what it would bring up and show in the States for two advanced practitioners of TM and AT, whether there were any similarities there. So on a lighter note, TM has, you know, mega celebrity endorsements. It's one of the features on their website. You know, I think I went onto the UK version and saw Hugh Jackman, you know, on there. And, you know, there's a whole list of celebrities that practice it and say that it's changed their life in some way. As I think any sitting practice where you're still and allow the stress arousal response to kind of dissipate is going to be beneficial. So also one of the things that I noted is the amount of research that's been done into TM and continues still to be done. And I think I might have got some, information here. Yes, so it's been the subject of numerous scientific studies exploring its potential benefits. And research suggests that practice, regular practice of TM can contribute to stress reduction, improved cognitive functioning, increased creativity and overall well-being. It is important to note that scientific opinions on TM's effectiveness can vary and more research is needed to fully understand its mechanisms and potential benefits. The other thing is that TM is a trademark technique and it's associated with the organization that was founded by the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. So there's specific guidelines and procedures for learning TM. And I think, I think I covered that. And the other thing to mention is I think the transcendental meditation movement, which is made up of programs and organizations that promote transcendental meditation, they have a net worth of about $3.5 billion. So there's a massive amount of money in this wider like organization, the umbrella organization. They have universities, hospitals. I think to date the US government had donated $20 million for research projects. So it's it's huge in comparison to autogenic training.
Thank you.
That was brilliant, Ben.
Fascinating.
Really brilliant.
I'd just
like to add to the thing about the state, the alpha state, which I've got here, which is interesting. Throughout the 2,500 years of meditative practice, the primary goal is to attain a changed state of consciousness. For practitioners of TM, awareness or bliss consciousness. So that's what the transcendental meditation seeks for, is awareness or bliss consciousness. For Buddhists, enlightenment. Mostly this state cannot be described, but can only be experienced. Now, that's a very interesting comment. It can't really be fully described. You have the experience. After long practice with loss of the self as a separate entity, the meditator is pervaded with the overwhelming and joyous knowledge that all of existence is a unit and that he is at one with it. With this powerful feeling comes the dissolution of all fear, an inundation of warmth, joy, and harmony. To one who has experienced this unity, it becomes the highest truth. Well, I'd like a bit of that.
Yes.
I like a bit of that.
Well, I've got a big question, because I mean all of that sounds quite extraordinary and universal and all of that. Where does it leave autogenic training? And it's discharge and it's way. I mean, you mentioned the word beneficial, which I wrote down, Bev, with a question mark, because, you know, it said the TM is beneficial, or we, if you do this and do this, you find it's beneficial. What are the benefits?
Well, we've got lowered blood pressure and all the physiological.
Excuse
parameters.
Me, I'm still just wondering what they're going to be. And a lot of meditation, I understand, is practiced without using relaxation. So that's another thing. But would, if you can learn TM in 1 week, what happens to the person who starts doing a process, which could be what we understand as an autogenic process with all its difficulties? Pia?
I told Anne this here the other day. I have a lot of experience with TM, and yeah, and I never talk about this, but when I was 14, I got into, after learning it, and I was so keen because I was so suicidal and whatever, I had an experience that totally and utterly transformed my life. I became one with everything and everything, and I cannot put words on it, it's impossible, but it changed my life, and that has been the direction for my whole life, really. When I was 17, I met somebody that said, oh, they would like to learn TM, because it was very big in Denmark at that point in time, and if I want to go to a talk. So I went to the talk, and they were talking about this thing about, and it was very, it was actually a dentist, in very well-known dentist in Denmark, that was one of the leaders for TM in Denmark. And he was talking about all the research, because they did so much research about it. And they talked about the state that we can get people into: weightlessness, disappearing, being one with all. And I said, oh my God, this is what happened to me in all those years ago. So I, after the class, I said, listen, this is what happened to me. And I said, can you explain more about it? Talk to me. So I explained what happened and tried to, there's no words for it. And he said, oh, I think TM would be very good for you. So I paid the money for it. I got my mantra. I gave them all the fruits and the flowers and all that stuff you have to do for them and whatever. And I sat for 20 minutes, and I had my, and it goes when, and I actually went to work at their resort as well, their TM resort. So there was sitters and stuff where they actually hop, they levitate and levitate or whatever it's called. It does happen. And I realized that all that they're doing is basically, they say this mantra, but it takes so long for them to get a relaxation. So long. Where in AT, it takes 8 weeks, and we can have an effect on it very quickly. So I left it, and I said, I had my spiritual practice. And for me, AT has been my spiritual practice for since then, since I was 12, really. So it is really interesting with TM. It really is. But there is nothing like AT.
I'm fascinated, because thank you so much for that. And still there's a missing link, because TM surely creates a situation where a process, shall we call it unloading or whatever, you know, the stuff that where the discharges and so on, surely that should be going at the same, because otherwise, how close is this? Bev?
Yeah, so before I learned AT, I had a meditation practice, and I've tried, I've practiced with mantra meditation before. And my experience of that is it's more cognitive. You know, it leads to transcendence, whereas what I'm much more interested is an embodied mm-hmm. experience. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely that to be said. And I've lost my thread about what I was going to talk. But in the other practices I've had of meditation, like I've done some chanting, I've done a cath meditation, which is focusing on a point in the belly, I've noticed discharging happening before I'd learned AT and I knew what it was. So I'd notice an emotional discharge. So I might find suddenly I am sobbing. Mm-hmm. So some emotions being released, or I would mm-hmm. notice twitching in my legs and things. Mm-hmm. So when it came to learning about discharge, it made absolute sense to me. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why I explain it the way that I do. There's something about the relaxation response when we're not holding on so tightly that the body goes, ha ha, let's just let go of these things. Mm. Yeah.
And that surely, this is always the thing that I come back to, it's relaxation that does the job.
Yeah.
And then, of course, what we have in autogenics, and nobody's talking about relaxation. Nobody actually says, go and relax your arm and area. That's coming in my bit later on. And in meditations, it took, as you said, Pia, so long to get to a point. So the relaxation is maybe that's where the origins of the autogenics being hypnosis, where relaxation is a key thing for the induction. Perhaps that's the connection. And that, because it worries me that people might be entering an altered state and going into something and then not understanding what happens next. It sounds like you really did, both of, well, you had learned AT, Pia, and Bev, you had a sense of when something was going on in you that, and you could go with it, and that's fine. But if it's some sort of flashback or difficult material coming up, there doesn't seem to be any guidance for it, whereas of course that's exactly what we do have, and we've got some management tools.
I certainly believe that our body is the doorway to spiritual
absolutely input. But somebody has to understand that for a complete novice, where things have, you know, they've never done any of this kind of work before.
No, and if you sell some out-of-body experience, you know, to people, they're like, yeah, let me escape
my
human suffering and go to space where I can be at one. Spiritual, yeah, absolutely.
Spiritual bypassing, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And well, it's not AT.
A lot of our populace resorts to mind-altering drugs.
Yes,
never mind. Meditative practices,
yeah.
It's mind bending and mind altering substances.
Yeah.
Which can do some of the work that we do naturally, but it's better to do it naturally. Of course it is. Who's next? We're at 20 to 1. We're at 20 to 1. We've not got, what have we got? Two Donnas.
This is a juicy topic, this. We're all, it's not 5 minutes worth, is it?
We might move into the afternoon, maybe. I don't quite know. We'll see. Donna?
Yes, well, I had two. I had mindfulness and hypnosis. Thrown together a little bit, I'm afraid, because I lost the use of my laptop for a little while. And doing it on a phone wasn't happening. So mindfulness, I've heard a lot about mindfulness. I've heard a lot of bad things about mindfulness, as well as a lot of good things. So I was quite intrigued to find out what it is, really. the official definition, apparently, is mindfulness is paying attention on purpose in the present moment without judgment. And what that really means, mindfulness is a state of being when your body and mind are in the same place at the same time. That means bringing attention to what you're doing and where you are without worrying about the future or past. So it sounds quite autogenic, but it's being done whilst you're walking up the stairs or washing up. Whatever you're doing is active. You can do it mindfully. That's what I was taking away from it. There are 7 pillars of mindfulness, which is non-judging, patience, having a beginner's mind, which it says it's easy to lose yourself if you begin to believe that you've heard, seen, and experienced everything. So I suppose you go back to being childlike and curious, I'm thinking, that mind just word came to my mind. Having trust, your non-striving, acceptance, and letting go. So again, it all sounds very similar to what we encourage when we're in an autogenic state and we're witnessing and not judging and accepting and going with. There are no postures, like I say. You can do it washing up, walking. They do mindfulness walking, I've heard, where you go and walk mindfully. So obviously there's no relaxation response as such being activated because you're active. And it doesn't tell you really what, I don't think it tells you really what to do with your mind. I'm washing up mindfully, but what am I thinking about? Am I thinking I've got the dish wet, or I wasn't quite sure. So I went on a little bit, and they do a mindfulness meditation. Again, I've heard their body scans are hugely long. I don't know for sure. I've never experienced it. So this is sort of secondhand from other people. But what I have found out is you sit upright, which is different to AT because you're holding your back straight. And then you're supposed to focus on the present, paying attention to bodily sensations, thoughts, emotions, and especially the breath. Again, sounds very autogenic, but what are we doing again with our mind? Because it can be doing other things while I'm watching my breath. It can be writing a shopping list, is what I kept coming back from. I think the big thing I took away from this, and I did only look into it very briefly, is mindfulness, I think, is what we're left with when we've done an autogenic course. I think people live more mindfully. Actually, that's kind of what I took away from the big picture of it.
Yes.
It's almost a side effect, because I was thinking, I do now do things a lot more mindfully. I'm not in an autogenic state or anything about it, but I am now watching the telly and I'll watch it, or I am reading a book and I'll read it, rather than I'm watching the telly and reading a book and listening to my daughter. So I've learned, and that came, I think, with autogenics, as I just became more into me. I do go and wash up. I am more present in myself, and I think that came from autogenics. It put me back into me. So it gave me more mindfulness. But I'm not an expert, and I didn't perhaps go into this as, you know, some of this that I've picked up could be wrong. It was an internet thing. So if there's a mindfulness expert there, you could probably argue with some of those points, and I would put my hands up. I haven't experienced it for myself, because everything I've heard, it's very infuriating. People can get very infuriated with being mindful. And I don't think they should, because coming out of autogenics and being mindful, it's very easy and it's very nice. But I've heard you have to practice 2 or 3 times a day, and you have to do it whether you want to or not. And it becomes a forced thing. And I heard that from somebody who went and then trained to do autogenics, actually. And I can't remember his name.
I think that's fascinating, because I'm wondering if, in fact, because you had done autogenic training and you had then done that work, and maybe things had, you'd had a few discharges or sort of insights or whatever else, because our method has a different focus to it, then perhaps it's very easy then to meditate and that's all done, if you see what I mean.
Mm.
I mean, there has been quite a bit of publicity about, I'll call it negative effects, that's the wrong word probably, of mindfulness, where people have been left actually in quite a bit of distress and they haven't known how to manage what's gone on. And it sounds to me as though a bit of an autogenic process has gone on, but they haven't had any support to help them through it. So they walk away from meditation or mindfulness or whatever it is, you know, might not be very helpful.
And that would fit with why people find it infuriating, because maybe it's the anger that's bubbling up.
Yeah.
And they've just got to go and sit and watch their breath.
Mm-hmm.
Which isn't very helpful at times when you're not in that frame.
I did a mindfulness course, a full 8-week mindfulness course, you know, particularly to sort of experience what it was. I went with Tamara some years ago. And I think remembering back, obviously there were a lot of crossovers, but I remember that you start off with the mindfulness of eating. So the beginning of any course is the leader puts a raisin in your hand and you put it in your mouth and you experience it, you chew it, and you actually totally focused on all the senses, the chewing, the taste, the texture, the concept and all that. So that's the beginning of focusing your attention on the present, on the moment, on the function, on the experience. And then we did mindfulness of breath, which has a lot to do with actually breathing in a certain way, which is very different to the autogenic practice where we allow the breath to do itself. This is very much about directing the breath, breathing exercise. And there's a mindfulness of walking, where you focus on walking. So those were exercises. And then as far as the body scan was concerned, now that was really interesting because we did the body scan like we did, but it was long. It was probably, 10 minutes is a long time, isn't it? Probably 5 minutes, a bit longer. More.
I've heard of them being half an hour.
No, yeah. It wasn't half an hour.
Yeah.
Possibly 10 minutes. But I must say, just using the body scan does induce the relaxation response. So that was that was very interesting.
Surely only if you're sitting in a posture which can
well,
help
you were sitting,
that
you
minute.
Were sitting in a chair.
And you were not holding anything, because that was Donna's point, that if you're sitting with a straight back, nobody's going to relax.
Well, it was just sitting. Well, you say sitting comfortably.
If you're sitting comfortably, that's different.
You adopt,
I'm
you
just
adopt
picking
an ease position. It's not a particular posture. You're on a chair. You are sitting, and you are comfortable. So, it didn't have a lot of instruction as to where your body should be, but you were in an ease position. And you didn't have your legs crossed, and you didn't do this, and you didn't do that. Just a simple sitting position. So those are the things I remember. And then there were some. Silence.
We must
silent
move on.
We
must move on. It's 10
yes,
to 1.
Yeah.
Sorry, because we're now just talking about it rather than actually looking at the comparisons. Thank you. Donna, you were going to do hypnosis?
I was, yes. Again, quite a brief one, which is probably a blessing if we're short on time. So hypnosis, derived from the Greek word hypnos, which is Greek for sleep, although hypnosis is not sleep. It's a natural altered state of mental and physical awareness which occurs when brainwave frequency slows down. It is a state that we all experience frequently when we daydream or just before and after we sleep. So it's a safe and non-invasive way of accessing the subconscious mind, which is the source of all our behavior. It's an altered state in which the brainwaves are slowed down. And even without any suggestion, the experience of extreme relaxation can have a profound effect in itself. So it's similar to AT with those things. Hypnotherapy works by directly accessing the subconscious mind and in a therapeutic setting, creating a state of relaxation where the conscious mind becomes less active. When this occurs, the subconscious mind becomes open and receptive to positive suggestion and reinforcement. And they are integrated much more effectively than is possible while the conscious mind is alert. That reminded me of our personal motivation.
Absolutely, yeah.
So the difference, that's very similar to AT with that. The difference is a hypnotic state is usually induced by a hypnotherapist. So you need a therapist. You must willingly accept and follow their suggestions in order to enter an altered state of awareness. With AT, obviously, we do that on our own. It says, in essence, all hypnosis is really self-hypnosis. However, in a therapeutic setting, you are guided. And with AT, you're only guided whilst we teach you. So that is a difference. We don't guide, we just tell them where to put their attention, really, to help them learn the statements. It's not a guided thing, which hypnosis usually is. So it doesn't let you go free. You stay with the therapist and go where they take you. But there's a lot about changing your belief patterns and what have you. The problem I have with that, I think, is you need to be aware of these beliefs and where the problem is cognitively to be able to know what you need to be hypnotized for. And I think the beauty of AT is we don't have to know any of that because our body knows what it needs to know and what it needs to let go of. And I might not be able to tell you what I need help with because I might consciously not know it, but AT would fix it or sort it or help it or do whatever it needs to do. With hypnosis, it might be missed because I might be so focused on giving up smoking that what actually I need to do is something else that even I'm not aware of. So that's where I got with that, really.
Excellent. Yes, thank you, Donna. Yeah, thank you.
It's really fascinating, isn't it? Thank you very much. And that summing up at the end, well, it wasn't the summing up, but just that awareness, of course, that we don't actually know. And I can remember when I started AT, I didn't know why I wanted to do it. Yes, I did. There were things that had been going on in my life, but I didn't know internally what that was doing for me and what I needed from it. I had no idea.
No. So how would you tell a therapist?
How? You can't. You're then relying on the therapist again. And that, of course, takes us right back to the beginning with Schultz was trying to find a way to help his patients, to help themselves and not be so therapist dependent.
Yeah.
So that really does show up the differences.
Mm.
Absolutely. Yes. Amazing. Thank you so much. Wow. Now, in three minutes, I might be able to do progressive muscular relaxation.
And the time starts now.
This has happened to me before. I was trying to find the talk that Anne and I contributed to back in 2016, and I couldn't find it anywhere. Now, what I have got in my hand here is a transcript from a presentation that Luther gave back in a conference in 1977. You can't quite see it on there. And I have transcribed it, and it's really interesting. It is progressive relaxation and autogenic therapy. He was calling it therapy in those days, just as we did. Similarities and differences. And he did know Jacobson, who devised the progressive relaxation technique. And there are a few letters from the two of them, sort of deciding they might or might not collaborate. And I'm going to send you this whole 13-page document. It is really interesting. I'm just going to pick out a few things for today, which are really what we are focusing on, sort of differences. And also, we must bear in mind Luther's inevitable bias. He knows about autogenic training, which nobody else at that conference, or maybe very few people, knew about. And that therefore, when Jacobson was also talking, everybody would have known, or lots of people would have known about progressive muscle relaxation. Now, just in an absolute nutshell, I know very little about it. So it's an even smaller nutshell. I went on a sleep clinic course a few years back where they teach the progressive muscle relaxation method. So there we were, and I was training to be working in the sleep clinic, which was nonsense, but the hospital wanted me to do some training. So that's what I picked. Very interesting to find out about it, actually, and the CBTI methods they use. And part of that was when you're in bed and you're not sleeping, you can do the PMR, which is progressive muscle relaxation. And so you, first of all, and probably you know this already, you can clench your fists, for example, and then let them go. And you clench your fists again, and you then let them go. And the idea is that you are teaching. Now, have I lost the place there for what I was going to just pick up on? But to have an attitude of, yes, no, sorry, that was wrong. You're teaching the client, the person, to be extremely aware on a very, very minute detail level what it feels like to relax. And the idea, of course, is you're going to enhance that. And the more you do it, the better you do it, and so on. And the more effective it is. And the whole focus was on relaxation only. But what really surprised me when I came to really reading this and realizing how very different it was to autogenic training, and I'm going to pick up just a little bit here. It's differences in terminology, Luther is writing here. So I'd like to convey a distinction between PR, progressive relaxation, and AT. In the context of PR, Jacobson emphasizes terms like self-operations control, self-engineering, control of the mind, tension signals, tension control, cultivation of the muscle sense, proceeding in a mechanical manner, going into the negative direction, power off, and similar verbal expressions that are related to a mechanistic world. I was so struck by that. And of course, Luther goes on himself. In AT, there are no terms of control of the mind or tension or self-operations. The emphasis of autogenic methods and procedural detail is not designed to control biologically given systems. The autogenic approach is distinctively different. The emphasis is on helping natural systems utilize their inherent potentials for self-regulatory adjustment more fully. So I'm just teaching grandmothers to suck eggs at the moment by saying all that. But he goes on to use our terms, pro-homeostatic, anti-homeostatic, self-regulatory systems, adaptation of treatment program. That's interesting. Individual tailored approach, psychophysiologically adapted stimuli. Actually, I'm going to come back to individually tailored approach. That can get really badly confused with people messing about with what they actually teach in autogenic training. The standard, I always stick to standard, and there's very little you would ever have to individually tailor. So mental contact, passive concentration, self-regulatory phenomena. He was just, those differences in terminology, I felt, spoke volumes between only relaxation. And somewhere else in the article, he writes about, that was on page 11, about the manner of how things are corrected, what things are pointed out, and how it is done. And he's very sharp, and it's almost militaristic, and say, no, you've got the wrong idea here. Go in the negative direction. The physician does not hesitate to interrupt the patient at a moment when he is failing in the attempt to relax and criticize him vigorously. And how on earth can that be helpful? It was quite an extraordinary thing to be reading here. And it's Luther's reading of Jacobson's work. He's quoting Jacobson here. You've got to be very, very, very stern and make sure that they don't. No, you're not relaxing. And I thought, whoa.
Luther was very strict.
Luther was, but not in comparison to what that is. Luther was emphatic about what he did and how he did it and the approach we should take, which was not actually a stern approach. It was very let go and very easygoing, which is what he writes about here. But he was emphatic about that, at least. But this was this guy, and somewhere else I have read, although it wasn't about Jacobson, but it was another, I think it was, might have been Seeley, was it? Who, if people were laughing in their autogenic exercises or in some sort of relaxation method, he would stop them. No, that's wrong. We don't laugh. You're not allowed to laugh. And I was quite shocked to read that too, because laughter is perfectly natural. And if something is going on in our altered state, then why shouldn't it? What is wrong with laughter? Nothing wrong with it at all. Sorry, I've diverted a bit. That wasn't Jacobson. That was somebody else. But I was so struck by this difference of approach. How can anybody possibly relax with somebody looking at every single move and every single little tiny thumb movement and then tell them off? I mean, unless I've completely misunderstood it, I just couldn't get there. Quite interesting. And on this sleek thing, I was trying it like everybody else was. You know, we were all sitting there doing our feet and our fists and everything else, and it meant nothing to me. Of course it didn't, because I'm doing AT, so there we are.
I find the minute somebody says relax, you instantly do the opposite.
That's the beauty of autogenic training. We never use the word relax. Of course we do in places, of course we do, but never in the actual practice. It simply isn't there. So there's no chance for the brain to say, oh no, I can't do that. Oh no, oh no, not something. There's no chance.
And that's why I wrote the R words.
Oh, yes, Anne.
Yes. I mean, I have a bit that I think someone's got it somewhere, that I said, you know, I never allowed my, I banished the word relax and asked people for different words. And then one day I just looked up all the R words in the dictionary,
yes,
and got about 50.
Yes.
I think you've had them, haven't you?
Yes.
50 words.
Yes.
Refresh, renew, repair.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah. So all of those, I took all the words that are appropriate,
yes,
and one of the ones that was made me smile, and I'm not quite sure what this means, was re-man.
Oh yes.
I don't know whether that was anyway that they're so I always encourage people to use a different word which had a different meaning, and relax is an emotive word.
Yes.
It has an immediate response.
Mm.
I can't do it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Or, I mean, how often have we heard people say, I've never been able to relax?
Yeah. The doctor, dare I use the word, says, what you need is to go home and relax, yes, and then you'll be all right.
Yes, yes.
Mm.
And they're quite right, of course, but the person can't do it for all of these reasons. Yeah. And I think this is the most perfect way to end our morning session with the reminder of your R words. Thank you so much. They are wonderful to read. They just make me smile. Yes, sorry, Pia.
Okay. Well, I think I'll leave you to it this afternoon, and I think I'm going to see you tomorrow.
Okay.
Group supervision.
Group dynamics. Yes.
So,
okay.
I've sent a document round, which is the theoretical basis. So I thought what we could do, Jane, you and I, on a Morecambe and Wise sort of thing, is that is let you decide which one you are. I'll introduce the theory, and you can come in with the experience and what happens in an AT group. And I thought that might work quite nicely.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I hope it will. I'll have enough stories that bubble up.
I'm sure you will.
We will see. Okay.
And if you haven't, I'll think.
Then you will fill in the gaps, and Donna, of course, as well. So
yes, and Donna, yeah.
And we're going to be looking at resistance this afternoon. So if that's so, yes, Bev, yes. You're muted, Bev.
Muted.
Thank you. Yeah, Pia was just mentioning that she was going to talk about Zen meditation.
Oh.
I know we're going to break for lunch, but I'd love to hear, because I don't know anything about Zen. So at some point, even if you want to just chat, I'd love to get a quick overview of from new practices. It.
Yeah, I am so sorry.
I don't know how
it is that you're not on that list. Something's gone wrong.
It's all okay.
Because
right.
It wasn't on the list, but Pia had experience with it, so...
Yes, absolutely. And actually, I'm wondering if I hand wrote it on the other list and I just left it off. I am really sorry. That is easily done, because we'll pinch a bit from this afternoon. That'll be no problem. Pia, shall we do that after lunch, or do you want to do it now?
Yeah. Oh, whatever. I'll do it very quick.
Yeah, it would be good for the recording to have it all in one.
All in one go. Now. Okay, that's fine. Good. Thank you.
2 minutes. Okay. So Zen. So Zen is basically a form of Buddhism. So in Buddhism, there is a few branches. There is the Tibetan Buddhism, and that is to do with prayer wheels and flags, and they do a lot of chanting. And then in China, it came more with the Buddhism, where it became more, it moved to Japan, and it became much less about practicing with chanting, and all it was to sit. So Zen means sitting. So Sa Zen is the practice of just sitting. There is nothing to do with, you don't need to sit with mudras or anything. You just sit. And in the olden days, you had to sit with a very, very straight back and with cross leg, like with what's it called, lotus. They don't do that anymore. Now you sit on a chair and you just sit and relax. And all Sasen is to observe the mind. Whatever comes, whatever goes, is just to observe what is, with no judgment, nowhere to go, nothing to do. So it's like just whenever a thought comes, you just watch it and let it flow past you, like a cloud, a white cloud on a blue sky. Just let it go. So there's no worship of any gods, no deities, no nothing. All they are is that they want to get in contact. Well, not that they want, but they say that we all have a true nature. And the nature is bliss and joy. And it's where there is no ego, there is nowhere to go, nothing to achieve. It is just to be. And they say that is our true nature, just being. And Zen is basically that, and I believe, because I'm very much involved with Genpo Roshi, is a Zen master that has come. You know, he's got the he's a successor of one of the Japanese. He's American, but he's alive. He's nearly 80, and what he talks about, the Zen state, is the 80 state, without a doubt, without a doubt. So when people, they sit in Zen meditation, they get to a point where it gets quiet. They just observe. They just let go of whatever is there. There's non-attachment to anything. There is just noticing what is, with no judgment, just allowing what is. And there is just detached observation. And there's non-striving. There is no judging. I've said that. And there is no, out of that state, when they sit, when they live life, Zen living is to be non-judgmental and just allow life to happen. So they don't react to life, they respond to life. They believe that, and I can't really say they believe, because they experience that state of being, where it has to do with mindfulness, where there's so much in the moment, living moment to moment, and life will give the right action, will bubble up, and we respond to that. So what I can see with the 80 state is very much the same, because it's, they become a witness. They have self-realization. There is so much, it's like this inquiry into their nature, to the ego. Why is it that I react like that? So they become so mindful of themselves. And Zen and Buddhism is all about other people as well, and kindness to others, to oneself, but also to others. It's not a religion. I thought it was a religion many years ago, but Buddhism is not a religion. It is not even a philosophy. It just is a way of living. So with the autogenic self, you know, it's this thing of, I see it very much the same, resting in the awareness of who we are, our natural state, where there is no clinging to, you know, stress or anything, but when we are just relaxed, we live life, we can take life in, we can let life flow through us. And that's very much Zen living. So I see a lot of similarities in the Zen state and in the AT state, what I experience in the AT state and what they're striving for. So that's it. Now it's lunch. So yeah,
thank you so much.
Yes, I think this session has been absolutely brilliant, because really interesting, and so really interesting to have them close together so that you can watch and hear the overlaps. And thank you very much. That's brilliant. Thank you. Yeah.
Learned a lot.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Thank you, Pia.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if there's some kind of extra wisdom that is in Zen, where our processing, however it happens, might come up, and then people, I don't know, wisdom or maturity or whatever it is, they can allow that
and this is where they say, you know, that they might have a little shiver or something when they sit. Which is the discharge.
They don't name it, they just allow what is to be.
And that's what I love. And that's, to me, it's very much AT, you know.
It is, isn't it? Yes, because that my language these days is just notice what you notice.
Yeah.
Which is the same, isn't it? Yes. Yes.
Exactly.
Isn't that very fascinating?
It is.
It has. I echo Anne. Thank you. We've all
contributed. I'll see you tomorrow. Bye, everybody.
We'll see you tomorrow. Okay,
bye,
Anne.
Thank you.
Right. Bye. When are we coming back, ladies, after lunch? Do you want a shorter lunch break? I'm just, because we could come back at 2 o'clock as planned. Shall we do that for Pia's sake? She can get to bed that much earlier.
I'm happy with that. Whatever happens.
Do you need your hour for the dog?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll fit in. Don't worry. If you want to do 3/4 hour, that's okay.
I'm easy either way. I think we have to go with Pia.
I'm easy either way. Honestly, I'm not that tired. So whatever you want.
Okay. It's just that once you stop, I know that feeling, once you stop, and perhaps you are tired because it's the middle of your night. But I tell you
No, you go.
I was going to say, if we had the hour, it might leave you time to do an autogenic exercise, Pia, rather than just eating and rushing. Shall we do that?
I can have a longer rest. Yeah. And Jane, can I just ask, did we go through, maybe I've got the wrong sheet. Did we go at 10:45, the psychopathology?
No. No, I think I have sent you an updated, I hope I have. Sent you an updated timetable. I swapped them over because there was no point in having group supervision on Sunday. We really want to hear how you're getting on Saturday.
I just printed the wrong ones.
I think you did. And I'm sorry to have sent you so many.
No, that's me.
But the most recent one was on Monday, and those two things were swapped out. So it's just that those things were swapped to tomorrow instead.
That's okay. Not to worry. Good. Yeehaw.
It keeps us on our toes, Jane.
Yeah.
Yes, but my toes have turned into spades, I think.
Oh, no. Ouch.
Okay. And on that happy note, let's go and have some lunch. Yes.
Yes.
So when are we meeting again?
It's quarter past two.
Yeah.
Quarter past. Okay.
Quarter past. Whatever your hour is.